Like, how can I fight for folks? And I see the struggle and not at least give my birth parents the opportunity to tell me their stories as opposed to the stories that were being told to me about my parents.
In the final episode of our series, What Happened Then?, I bring you the story of Keisha, a family defender, educator, and activist. As a family defense attorney, she brings her personal experience being a foster care child into the heart of her work. She tirelessly advocates for parents who risk losing their children to the foster care system. While the episodes prior highlighted a time in history at risk of returning, where mostly white single women were forced to relinquish their children, we fail to realize that systems like those are still in place today, although they look slightly different and affect communities of color. Adoption and foster care are rooted in identity, those stolen and those hidden. To know these stories is to hope that one day we understand and we can change. This is Keisha's story. Keisha, welcome to About Your Mother, where your story begins. It's so lovely to have you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And I'm so excited to talk about your work and what you do, because as we've talked about, it's very important work that few people know much about. So let's start there. What inspired you to make the transition to your own practice as a family defender?
Wow, the transition. So for me, I think I want to start from the beginning of like why I decided to, I think, go to law school in the first place.
Oh, perfect.
And transition into that. So, you know, I started off or went to UC Irvine, and my professor was doing research on the Adoptions and Safe Families Act, which is a federal legislation that's a very key piece of legislation as it pertains to the type of law that I practice. And we were looking at incarcerated mothers and the consequence or the collateral consequence of them losing their children as a result of being in custody for too long. So this federal legislation essentially says, like, if a child is in the foster system for 15 out of the last 22 months, that states are required to initiate termination of parental rights proceedings. And that's a cap. It's not a ceiling. And so some states can go lower. So as long as it's within that realm, then they're good. So like in California, our laws are actually more strict in that if you have a child under the age of three, courts can initiate termination of parental rights proceedings at 6 months. And if your child is over the age of three, they can initiate at 12 months. And so what we were seeing was that the average sentence of women at that time was 18 months. And so women were literally, as a collateral consequence of being incarcerated, losing their children, having their rights terminated. And we like to call that the civil death penalty, because there really isn't like a meaningful mechanism to reverse your parental rights being terminated.
Wow. So give an idea of, if you're going incarcerated for 3 or 6 months, what have you done, for instance? Give an example so we can.
Yeah, I mean, it could be petty theft, right? Any type of misdemeanor crime, the sentence could be a year, up to a year. For a felony, it could be a year. Obviously, it's more than a year. And so it could be that you were engaged in what we would call like an Estes robbery, which is you go into Target, steal some makeup, and in your quest to try to get out of the Target, the security approaches you and you're struggling over the makeup. That would be considered an Estes robbery. And the sentence for that is 2 years.
Wow. And so without a doubt, all of those women were losing their children and going into the system. The children were going into the system.
Right. I mean, the states are required, if they were to get the federal funding from the federal government, to initiate termination of parental rights proceedings if the children were in the system for 15 out of the last 22 months.
That's insane. That's an incredible volume. What were some of those numbers that you were looking at?
You know, I can't remember off the top of my head.
No problem.
But what I do know is that the sentences for women have increased, right? The average length of time. And so we still are seeing this collateral consequence of women going into custody for nothing having to do with abuse or neglect of their children, but simply because they're in custody for too long. And what I do know is that when we look at the national data in regards to parents, so fathers and mothers who are in custody who also have a children in the system, we're looking at like 90% TPR rates.
And TPR is?
Termination of parental rights.
90%.
Yeah, or higher.
Oh, it's higher. Gosh.
it's higher when it's the mother in custody, because usually when the father's in custody, then maybe the child could go with the mom. But when mothers are in custody, it tends to be that there's not a father around either.
Wow. So you're motivated by this in college, and then you go on to become a public defender. What was that like for you?
Well, before I became a public defender, actually, my first job out of law school, literally, I passed the bar on Friday. Monday, I was representing parents in juvenile dependency court in Monterey Park, which another fun fact, which is a sad fact, is that Los Angeles has the largest local foster system in the country. And so it's just a huge volume of families that are impacted by this system, majority of them being Black families. And so I did that for about 2 years before I went on to be a public defender. And partly it was wanting to know what all the tools I had at my disposal to be able to navigate these cases, because I like to say in juvenile court, there's juvenile court rules that are not necessarily based in the law, but are just based in like the practice and the culture of the attorneys who practice there and the judges who preside over these cases. And so I just was like, I want to know what all the tools are in my tool belt to navigate these cases and then come back into the space. And that's what I'm doing now.
Coming back into the space. I love that. So tell us a little bit about your story and how this is connected to your childhood as well.
Right. Well, when I was doing the research I was telling you about in undergrad, I had no idea what I was going to do after undergrad. Like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had no intentions of being a lawyer. And as I was doing that research, I would always ask my professor for extended deadlines, because I got so just ingrained in not only the stories of the families that I was reading about, but also learning about a system that had impacted my entire childhood. So I was raised, I would say raised in the system, in the sense that I came into the system when I was 2 years old, and I quote unquote aged out of the system. And so learning about this world and learning about the injustice that incarcerated mothers were facing, I just wanted to learn more. It was kind of like in tunnel vision, to be honest with you, just on this quest to learn more. And as I learned more, there was this kind of incredible healing that happened as a consequence of that. And then as I was actually practicing in court representing parents, I realized it wasn't just incarcerated moms that were facing this injustice. It was really entire communities, right? And specifically my community as a, you know, Black individual in this country, and that this system disproportionately impacts Black and Indigenous families. And so as I learned about just the history of the system, the ways in which the system has really frayed and separated Black families, and it really, one, gave me more grace for my birth parents, and also made me want to, you know, learn and get to know them, because, you know, the folks that I was sitting next to representing and seeing how hard they were fighting for their children, and just seeing how everything is so stacked, and kind of like once you're in it, it's really hard to get out of it. And there's all these obstacles to reunification, that it made me question the stories that I had been told in regards to my parents didn't fight hard enough for me, or my parents were these hopeless, you know, addicted individuals who you just were not, quote unquote, good for me to be in community with, if you will. And that really put me on a quest to get to know my own birth parents, because I, like I said, I was like, how can I fight for folks? And I see the struggle and not at least give my birth parents the opportunity to tell me their stories, as opposed to the stories that were being told to me about my parents. And so from there, I, you know, had the opportunity to meet my birth parents. My mother lives here and was living, I grew up in multiple different places. I went to high school in Diamond Bar and went to college at UCI, and my birth mother was living in Anaheim. And my father was as well at one point, but then he ended up getting deported in 2005. Mm-hmm. I'm half Nigerian. So my father was deported back home. And part of my journey too was going back to Nigeria, meeting my father in person. And the person that I met there was completely different from the image of who he was that people had told me about him. And if you ever met my father, like, he's definitely, like, you would never know that he's ever struggled with substance use disorder. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And you know, I love a story where your work is your work because one, it's deeply connected to your childhood, mm-hmm. but also helping you put the pieces together on what the reality really was.
Right.
And I think these institutions that are formed on that quote unquote benefit of children don't necessarily benefit the children at all.
Oh my God. Yes. I think that's like the, I think that was like the biggest farce. And that was something that even before I started researching and stuff, I mean, when I was in high school, they have this thing called like Celebration 1, Celebration 2 in Los Angeles. And what it is, it's like, if you're graduating and going to college, if you're going to like a 4-year college, then it's like Celebration 1. And if you're going to like a, you know, community college, they do Celebration 2. But it's like all the media is out there and like the, you know, department is taking, you know, basically saying like they're responsible for the progress that we've made and the success, our success. And I just remember there just talking to other folks who were there too. And we were just like, why are they taking, you know, attributing themselves to this, you know, like,
yeah,
we survived. Yeah, you know, they're sitting here acting as if they contributed to it. And that also was like a problem for me. I will say about my mom, and when I say my mom, I'm talking about, I guess people would say my foster mom. Mm. But she was very, 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 very protective in not having us be exposed too much to like the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
she protected you.
Yeah.
And were you with her the whole time? Do you mind me asking? Were you with her throughout the duration?
A majority of the time. So prior to coming to my mom, and I came to her like nearly 3 years old. I was still in my twos and I came in at two. I was already in two foster homes before I came to my mom. Mm-hmm. But from there, yes, I was raised with her. And the unique part of my experience in the system, which is not normal, is that my mom also fostered four of my other biological siblings as well. So five of us were raised together.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's great. She sounds wonderful.
Yeah, she is. Yeah.
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 And did she take in other children from other families, or was it just your family?
She did when we were younger, but ultimately she ended up with just the five of us. And so she, and I have to also, my mom's oldest daughter, her biological daughter also helped raise us as well. So both of them, I think, played a really key role in raising us who we are today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, she did a great job.
Thank you.
She sure did.
Yeah.
So is it, you know, about the series I was doing before about closed adoption and mm-hmm. adoptees wanting to find their, their birth parents.
Mm-hmm.
I would assume it wasn't hard for you to find your parents, or is that something that's kept away from you?
Yeah, so adoptions in California are also closed out of the mm-hmm. foster system.
Okay.
In my experience, my family found me. So because of, I don't know, there's this thing called like guilt, foster guilt, where I feel like my life, I was taught to just be grateful for the experience that I had, right? Experience of being raised by my siblings, my mom taking us in, and I felt really like this incredible guilt, even with the thought of desiring to get to know my birth family. And a part of the way I cope with that, and I've come to learn that it's actually like a thing, is like, I just told myself that my parents were dead. My birth parents were dead. And it was easier just to kind of just be like, kind of move along, if you will. And when I was in undergrad, so all of this happened, like undergrad and the research and all that stuff all happened in undergrad. In 2006, I'm one of eight. So there's eight of us total. The oldest of us, she hired like a private investigator to find us. She found my sister, my oldest sister that I was raised with first. And then they called me together and she was like, hi, I'm your sister. The funny thing is that at the time I was trying to pledge to become a member of a sorority. Uh-huh. And so I thought it was like the sorority calling me and being like, you know, like, like catty and stuff like that.
What do they call it? Rushing. Yeah. It was like part of the initiation, right?
Right. Because I didn't know I had other siblings. I thought it was just the five of us. I didn't know that there was three other ones. And through that experience, I found that I had actually met my older sister before and my grandmother, but my mom would always just say that these are friends. She never said, this is your sister. She never told me that this was my grandmother. And so that's when I found out during that period of time, and that just shook my whole world upside down. At that point, I think I was 20 or 21 years old, and it just was it was just like a big, like, whoa, right?
Like a firework going off in your life and just being like, everything's different than you thought it was. Right,
exactly. Yeah. So that was hard. And I think for my relationship with my mom, it really shook our relationship.
Your foster mom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I know terminology. Yeah, okay. Everybody has a different way of doing it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, it shook my world because, you know, and I get now, but at the time, my mom, it was, I think she didn't want to like lose us to anybody, if that makes sense. And so it wasn't a supportive atmosphere, right? It was like, if you choose to explore that or figure that out, you have to do that on your own. And I felt this kind of like, I shouldn't even say felt. I mean, my mom straight out was just kind of like, you have to choose type of thing.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a really difficult time. Now, you know, our relationship has been mended and things like that. And I understand that it was a protective measure that she took, but I consider myself to be a pretty happy person, a pretty resilient person. And that period of time for me was a very dark and depressing period of time.
I'm sorry. Navigating that.
Yeah,
especially in those 20s. Those 20s can be really hard, right? Everything you say there, and you say it so eloquently, is every adoptee that I've spoken to feels the guilt of wanting to know where they come from, who they come from, that type of thing. And then the guilt is pervasive. And then the other thing is the adoptive or foster parent that take the children in, protective of their place. And I can relate to that so much. And then also having kind of the wool pulled out, because I remember at 14 when my mom told me that she had given up her firstborn for adoption and that for my birthday, my 18-year-old brother was going to show up. I was just like, what? You know, it's like this, it's like an explosion goes off in your life. And while it's celebratory, it's still complex. Right. You know, and I think it, and I think because it's such a, you know, someone once told me adoption, foster care in this situation is a series of uncomfortable conversations that we don't talk about it as much in the open,
right?
Because there's so many deep feelings around all of these different relationships.
Exactly. And I love it. Yeah, I love that you characterize it as complex, because I think that also owning that was also part of like healing, I think, for me and my mom, right? Like owning that, having those tough conversations. You know, I remember sitting down with my mom being like, Liz, I understand that you're trying to protect this space. You're trying to also protect me, I think, as well, right?
Correct. Yeah.
But you have to also trust that you've done, like, you know what I mean? Like, nobody can replace my mom. Like, nobody can replace her. Just like nobody can replace my birth mother, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes things complicated. And this inherent desire to not just know where you come from, but also it's so much a part of your identity. And for me, like, because I'm like half Nigerian, there was also this like overwhelming desire for me, and it still is a journey that I'm on, to learn as much as I could about my Nigerian culture and heritage, like being in community with folks who are Nigerian and being like, I feel like a fraud or an imposter because like I just don't share those same, like,
you're disconnected from it somehow. Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, right, like it is the blood that runs through my veins, right? And I truly believe, you know, just in getting to know my story through the lens of my birth parents, I believe that the prayers of my grandparents is what, like, all of my siblings, listen, all of us, listen, I always say we are all bomb.com. We have all, like, we're all like amazing. And I just feel like the way that we were kept, you know, had to be from the prayers of my grandparents.
Oh, I love that. And I love bomb.com. Is that what you just do?
We just are. Listen, and I just don't, you sometimes you'll see it. Like one child, you know, is resilient and does well, but like all of my siblings, all eight of us, you know, are just doing amazingly well. And I just always say, but God, right? People ask me, like, why do I believe in God? Like, I don't see any other way that it could have been orchestrated.
Yeah. And the prayers, I love that too, that your ancestors, right. You know, Nigeria is, you know, the soil from which you come from. Of right. course you want to know
right.
more about that
right.
and how it shapes who you are and your resilience. I'm right. sure resilience right. is a big part of that too.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And so what was it like meeting your birth parents?
Oh man. So when I met my birth, I'll start with my birth mother first. I think that's the relationship for me that's more complicated. And I think it's more complicated in fairness it because while I have a mother figure in my life, right? Or someone who, I shouldn't even say figure, like she has been, she is a mom to me, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, that guilt of, right, getting to know her and letting her into the space. Does this take away from my mom? Does this take away? Like, what does that mean? And then she's here. So it's not as of a controlled space in the sense that, like, technically she could just pop up at my house or, right? Yeah. That relationship. So when I met her, I was actually dropping off, I think it was my little sister, to her home. And she came outside. And so it wasn't expected. Like, I just was going to drop my sister off and leave. She came outside and, like, actually didn't meet her, actually. Now that I'm telling the story, I just saw her.
Enough.
Yeah. And I was arrested by, I mean, she looked like a spitting image. And I hate, and my sister might be offended by this. She's beautiful, but, like, you know, just the tying of everything. But she looks almost exactly like one of my sister that I grew up with, my older sister that I grew up with. And I was like, oh my God, she looks like her. And then from there, it was, I am, like I said, one of eight. Three of my siblings were raised like with my birth parents, or at least in community with them, right?
Okay. So right.
My little brother was raised with them, right? He never was put into the foster system. Then my little youngest sister, she was there for like the weekends. She was adopted, but she would go to my birth parents and spend time with them on the weekends. And then my oldest sister, she's the one out of the eight of us that has a different father. And her father took her in out of the foster system and then would just let her still be in community with my birth mom. So in getting to know them, my other siblings, I was be in community with my birth mom, mm-hmm. not necessarily by choice, but because we were all in community together. Like if I wanted to go to my sister's graduation, my birth mom might be there and I couldn't tell my little sister not to invite her. Yeah. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So that relationship is a little rockier for me, to be honest. I think my birth mom carries a lot of guilt and I think I have to give more grace in the sense that I'm like, can you look me in the eye when you talk to me? Can you, right? Like, mm-hmm. and then there's, you know, so I don't know. And I know I should just give grace, but I think it's just like a safety protective type of thing. So that's where I'm at. And then at one point I forgave. And then when I got pregnant, had my own child, it like resurfaced so much for me. And so I'm always respectful. I'm always loving, but it is a complicated space. And I think for me, my goal or my desire has been to like do therapy and things like that. And that's just not where she's at. She kind of wants to just start like nothing ever happened and I can't, that's not where I'm at.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And then, she probably can't go there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I know. Yeah. It's hard. I get it. You know, I do. It's also emotionally not safe for me. And so for me, I think I have to be in an emotional space to give her the latitude or the space to manage the space the way that she wants to. But I'm just not right there right now. And like I said, with the baby, it made it even worse. I thought it would be
good. I'm so glad you mentioned that because I thought of my mom. She was in the delivery room with me because I knew she had really, you know, relinquished surrender. Mm-hmm. Everybody has language around it. Mm-hmm. Her firstborn. Mm-hmm. And when I was having my son, I was like, how did she do that? Mm-hmm. And then it began as he started growing up and we were forming our bond. That's when I began this work. Cause I was like, well, how did that all happen? And what do we do? I don't know if you feel this way. Well, you do. I think that's part of your motivation in college too, is, well, now what do I do with all of this mm-hmm. that I'm carrying with me,
right.
this experience? How do I use it as a tool? How do I get to grace with it all? Mm-hmm. But these mothers, they certainly carry a lot of shame. And I think I would say this to you, I do know my mom, although a little bit of a different situation, similar mm-hmm. at its core, my mom's shame swallows her voice. Mm-hmm. It's rendered her mm-hmm. nearly speechless about the experience.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's exactly what it is. It's like, and then it's me respecting that, because I'm just like, I don't understand, right? Like, I can understand it intellectually. Okay. I could literally, if my client was experiencing that, I would say, like, listen, I understand why it's difficult for you to have this conversation with your daughter, like, blah, 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 blah. And that's okay when you're ready, right? Like, I would totally do that. And I guess, and I will say this, I am a when you're ready. I am. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I'm like, I don't want to play house. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, right. I think there needs to be some, I'm not fully healed in this space. It's not emotionally safe for me. And I feel this, I think, kind of entitlement in the sense of like, I didn't create the situation. Mm-hmm. So I shouldn't be doing more work to be in the space, if that makes sense.
Yep, it does. and you deserve to have that be your truth, you know, in that. Yeah, it's right. complicated. Like I said, right. it's complicated.
It's so complicated.
It's so right. complicated. Right. Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, I know we just connected on so many levels right. of the tenets of these awkward, challenging situations that are right. hard to navigate.
Right.
And I do like people talking about it, because I do think in the end, you start to realize there's more similarity than you think. You know, mm-hmm. people are feeling a lot of the same emotions,
right?
That they just don't talk about.
Exactly. Like you said, we don't have conversations about it, and then we just carry it. And then sometimes a conversation can clear up so much, you know?
So much.
Yeah.
And you still don't have to like it. Oh, she's great. I don't know if you've listened to Jan yet. I love her voice, and it's not, she just comes out with it. She's, to your earlier point, she's like, you know, this idea that I was saved and that I was a chosen one. I don't connect with that. And I don't have to like that this is how it was.
Right.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. Well, okay. So we went there in a big, beautiful way. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. So now you're doing this work connected very much to your story, but now you're kind of, it's becoming bigger than your story. It's becoming mm-hmm. about the people you work with and for. Right. So what is this reality of this world that you are working in? Give us some, maybe root us in some of the injustices that you see that we started up with earlier. That was very kind of vivid, but what are some of the things that you see and kind of maybe the unfairness of the system as it exists today?
Well, I will, and, you know, forgive me if I'm going too deep, but part of the way that I understand this system is by understanding its history. And so when I look at the history of the so-called, what we like to call the child welfare system in this country, and I see how from its inception, right, it's always been a system to separate families that were deemed to be of color or to be impoverished. And so starting off with like the quote unquote orphan trains and this whole notion that like, you know, we're saving children who are quote unquote orphaned, even though in many cases they were not orphaned, and then sending them to, I don't want to say cultured, but basically sending them like to the Midwest and having them be raised in white evangelical, you know, communities and things like that. Like that was the design of the system.
It was.
And then a lot of us, you know, are familiar with the ways in which the system, you know, systematically and like government sanctioned destroyed Native families. And then when we talk about my community was largely excluded from the quote unquote foster system until we won, you know, the rights to welfare, right, during the civil rights era. And then as a consequence of that, it became just even more punitive. Like you see this, like, if you want, or if you seek help for things like housing, if you seek help for things like you're the victim of domestic violence, if you're suffering from substance use disorder, right, then we're going to take your children from you, right? If you're suffering from poverty, and that still happens, right? A lot of these cases are families dealing with issues that could be resolved if we were to just give them their basic needs and necessities. And so we see like this huge increase in the rise of families of color, specifically Black and Indigenous families in the foster system, when there's a divestment from like welfare and right other types of community aid to families, and an increase in the number of children in the system. As sometimes we talk about the war on drugs and we only talk about the impact it had on Black communities in regards to incarceration, but we don't talk about how simultaneously there was a rise in the number of Black children who were, you know, put into the foster system as a result of quote unquote, you know, drugs and things like that, right?
Right.
So that for me is just kind of the framework that I look at this system. I think that it is rooted in racism and rooted in, you know, punishing families who might suffer from poverty. But the injustices that I see like on a day to day, I always compare it to criminal because I practice in both spaces.
Yeah.
It's the fact that like, that when we talk about due process, when we talk about just this very, to me, precious liberty interest in having your children, right? Being able to raise your children, that right is not protected as fiercely as we protect the right to, for example, not be incarcerated, right? And not to say that that space is good, because it's not.
Yeah.
But we don't even have those types of protections and dependency. So for example, in a criminal context, the government, a police officer, cannot ask you questions without you being read your Miranda rights. And if they do, if you're in a carceral, in a, you know, custodial type of situation, then those statements can be excluded, right? In this context, we don't have any Miranda-like protection. In social workers, what I see, I mean, one of the things I do in my practice, I do a lot of pre-investigative or pre-petition advocacy. So I represent parents before there's a petition filed in court. And in those meetings, there have been times where in some counties, I'm just going to just say it out loud because
say it.
Call it out. In San Bernardino County, I have been told that I cannot advise my client in those meetings, that I cannot speak in those meetings. And when I have attempted to speak in those meetings, they have shut down the conversation. Okay. When I'm in these interviews, even though they're interviewing clients, so for example, I had a client I was in an interview with a few weeks ago, and they will ask, they were interviewing her because there was an allegation of physical abuse by the father who she did not live with. And those allegations were very menial. Like he threw a towel on the child and pinched the child, and there was no marks or bruises left behind. Okay. And the little boy was asked, you know, first of all, he's pulled out of class and he is embarrassed by that experience. It's traumatizing for children to be interviewed. And we don't often talk about just the
traumatizing
trauma. The children's experience. And when we look at some counties in like in LA, which is the largest local foster system in the country, Black children are nearly every 7 in 10 Black children are the subject of a CPS investigation.
Stop it.
No.
That's so many children.
7 in 10. And we act like it's just innocuous, like it's not that big of a deal, but there's a lot of harm that happens just in that initial
of course
investigation, right? Children are akin to being strip searched, in that they're physically have to remove their clothing to make sure there's no bruises and things like
oh,
that.
Poor babies.
They're oftentimes asked questions about behavior that maybe that they were not aware of in regards to their parents.
Yeah.
They get pulled out of class, which is embarrassing for them. Law enforcement. I had a little boy, 12 officers showed up to his house or his grandmother's house with guns pulled.
Oh my goodness.
To take him the day before his kindergarten graduation.
Oh my gosh.
Right? And that is just... That's just like, we don't talk about those types of traumas and harms that are happening just at the front end of things. Yeah. And there's no Miranda. Okay. But you're asking my client questions that could lead to
something like that happening.
Or even another allegation. So like in the case I was talking about with, you're investigating for physical abuse, but your questions are, do you suffer from mental illness, which is a allegation in a petition. Have you experienced domestic violence? Does the father use drugs? And if the father does use drugs and you say you know about it, that could end up being a failure to protect charge. Like there's all of these questions that they say that they just ask that are just normal questions when really they could lead to another allegation.
Right. And as you're saying that, I'm like, most of us can mark yes on all of those.
We could.
Right?
We could. And most of us do, thinking like, oh, these are just, if you're not represented, because the way it's posed is we ask all parents these questions, right? And if my client were to, because we don't have Miranda like protections, if my clients, and some clients do, some individuals will say, I am not going to answer those questions. Then they will say, we're going to tell the judge you're being uncooperative. And on that basis, we're going to seek a warrant to remove your children. Now, whether they could get one or not, if you're a parent in that position, are you going to take the risk, or are you going to answer the questions because you're not you're not being represented? No one's telling you you don't have to answer these questions, right? And in that case, I was representing. She said I can share this, so it's
okay.
But she's a judge, and they were trying to tell her that she had to answer these questions, and then they tried to tell her she had to go into, they had to do a home assessment to go into her home. And then the social worker said, oh, there could be hidden rooms in your home where you abuse your child. But her child said there was no abuse like happening in his mom's home, right? And so I was like, is it a requirement? They were like, yes. Yeah. Like, what is the regulation? And it's, oh, we don't know off the top of our head. Well, I know what the Fourth Amendment says. The Fourth Amendment says you cannot go into the home without probable cause.
Right.
And the county council said, do you want to test it?
Yeah.
And I really, like, I just was like, what would this, the person who I was representing has the social capital and wherewithal to, right, say,
yeah.
But what about folks who don't have that?
At all.
Right.
I mean, they must feel so desperate and hopeless, like their back is up against the wall.
Right. You
and
feel
I think
powerless.
You do. And it reminds me of these women in the decades before Roe who were forced to surrender, relinquish their babies, whatever you might want to call it, where they felt completely optionless.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that different.
Right.
It's really not that different. They just were like, well, if I want to run away with my baby and have my baby and keep my baby, but everybody around me tells me I can't.
Right.
And
but
it's
you're
not,
told that you have an option.
But you're told you have an option. And that, I mean, I've got to say it. That's fucked up.
Yeah, it is. It is. It really is.
It really is. And it's not like we were talking about before. It's how these two things are really adjacent.
Mm-hmm.
This foster care adoption triangle is, it's repeating itself and it's present today.
Right. It is. It very much so is. It's the, I mean, we talked about before we, you know, started the podcast, just it's akin to kidnapping.
Yeah. And
now, I shouldn't even say akin, because actually the research says that for children, it registers as being kidnapped.
Oh, those poor
babies. How their brain processes that trauma as a kidnapping, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's the front end when it talks about injustice. And then when we get into the case, it's like folks can anonymously report allegations of abuse or neglect and folks use that, right, so that they can retaliate against people. But you can't cross-examine them because you won't know who the person is. So I can't even bring out this person's bias. So in criminal court, where you have a Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, you don't have a Sixth Amendment right to confrontation in dependency cases. Your mother-in-law, who don't like you, who wants her grandbaby, can call in anonymously and say, mom is sexually abusing, or she's using drugs, or whatever she wants to say, and it won't be tested, right?
Social because it's closed, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a juvenile. It's closed.
Well, it's not because it's closed. It's the basis of it is the law, and that's not because not in every state, right? Like it is in this state, we allow for confidential reporting, right? We allow for anonymous reporting, right? And I mean, they say it's for confidentiality reasons, but if someone is making an allegation against you, you should have the right, to present to the person who has to make a decision regarding whether they're true, to be able to pull out why that person may be saying those things about you, what the motive is, what their biases might be, to be able to, you know, defend yourself. And you can't if it's anonymous, right? So we could go down the list like that.
Oh my heavens.
Reality, social workers' reports are considered to be evidence, even if there's five layers of hearsay in them. So it could be the auntie told the uncle, and then the uncle told the cousin, and then the cousin called CPS. And that is all in comes into evidence because it's written in the social worker's report, or the social worker, which I wish I could say this was a conspiracy, that this isn't true, but I've seen it in my own eyes, and I've actually also been misreported in social worker's reports, is a social worker can write, mom said X, or dad said Y, and it's not true, but it's in their report, so now it's taken as a true statement, right? So if you say, protection in criminal, no protection in dependency, the burden of proof, criminal beyond a reasonable doubt with a jury of your peers, dependency, the juvenile judge who presides over these cases all the time in what I like to call children's court world. And then, and then it's a preponderance of evidence that these allegations, and some of them are very serious allegations, are true. And then if you deny them, if you say, you know what, the court found, for example, I had a case where there was an allegation that a knife was thrown and caused a gashing wound. There was no physical evidence to support the gashing wound.
It was just that. The judge
still upheld the allegation.
Oh my heavens.
My client says, I am not going to admit to the fact that I threw a knife at my child.
Right.
Because it didn't happen. And that is now being used against my client to terminate their parental rights. Because they're not taking accountability for what they did. The court found it to be true. And I'm like, but with what evidence? And I keep getting counsel, we are not going to relitigate this case.
Yeah. Right?
So that happens. It's just so much. And nobody knows what's happening because we assume that we're dealing with parents like what we see on the media, right? Who really do have rooms and lock their children and they beat them like A Child Called It. That's what I always think about is A Child
Called It. Oh, yes. Did you read that book? I sure did. Dave, right? Yes. Yeah.
But that's what they think about when we're talking about these parents. And that is not what's happening that's not the types of cases you see. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are a few, right? That are really serious. But a majority of these cases are not that.
I think it's Turpin children, those poor babies that were locked to their beds and things like that. I mean, duh. Yes. I call them the cinematic cases. They're the ones that get the headlines.
Exactly.
But, you know, here I have this little research here, and you've referenced it before, that California has the largest population of foster care youth in the nation. And that This is horrific too. And that children in foster care also have to face disproportionately higher rates of mental illness in some studies that have shown as much as 50% basically of emotional and behavioral issues.
Right. Yes. And that number two, and it's another problem, right?
Yeah.
A lot of folks who are in the foster system, I don't use the word foster care.
Okay.
Because I don't think that we're caring for the children that are there.
Good point.
The foster system utilizes there's higher rates if a child is diagnosed with a mental health disorder. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so one of the things you see is an overdiagnosis of children in the system, an overprescription of very harmful psychotropic medication, such that there are lawsuits. I think in Maryland right now, they're doing a lawsuit because children were being just overly prescribed these very harmful, very powerful psychotropic medication. And it does two things. Like I said, it increases the rate of money that you can get for that child. Mm-hmm. And also it keeps the child who's dealing with trauma, where you don't have to, like, it helps them manage their behaviors better, mm-hmm. as opposed to getting them therapy, as opposed to placing them back with their parents, because maybe that's, you know, why they're acting out, because they want to be with their mommy and their daddy.
Exactly. Right?
And not putting the support system in place for a family that might be listen, I'm not saying that none of these families might be suffering from crisis and struggling, right?
Who is it?
Yeah. Put into place.
Yeah.
Right, to reduce your concerns about quote unquote maltreatment. Mm-hmm. And we don't do a reverse analysis about the harms of the system when we're talking about quote unquote best interests of children, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that number, I always question it, because I'm like, how many of these diagnoses are accurate when we talk about mental health? Okay, but what we do know when we talk about statistics is that children are more likely to be physically abused and sexually abused while they're in the foster system.
There you are, right?
Right.
It's maddening. How do you take care of yourself dealing with all of this coming your way?
You know, in the past, part of because like I said, I've been in criminal for some years, right? And in that position, I was more of a consultant to cases where there's a crossover, because there's oftentimes a crossover with criminal and dependency. And so I've done that both in state and federal criminal practice. So this past year has been the year of me kind of coming back and not only doing dependency as a majority of my practice, but also like I'm a new mom, right? And so in January, actually, so just a few months ago,
it is.
I went to a conference where I met Heidi.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Heidi.
And one of the women that I met there, she asked me the same question you asked me, essentially. And I said, my days consist of typically falling asleep on a case, waking up. I have been going to the gym. That's become a regular practice of mine. It helps me to release every day. And then I come home, take a shower, and then start my day. And she invited me, and I've been doing this, and it's been amazing, to make sure, even if it's 2 minutes, to take a very hot shower in the evening and wash off my day. Mm. And visualize it. And even if I need to verbally release my day, to watch it go down the drain. And for me, I am a believer in God, to release that unto God and that family unto God, because I am not a savior. I'm not Jesus, right? I am just here to do my part, right? And walk with the families that I have the privilege of walking with for that moment, for that day, and then release it. And that has been a practice that, one, I'm like, it's crazy how we like go through life and we are suffering and we don't give ourselves permission to like
permission to suffer, right? Or to feel it, to feel the feels. We do.
Right. Like it took somebody else telling me to give myself permission to do that, mm-hmm. for me to even have the thought to do that, right? And it's just been a gift. So I do want to just shout out, and then her name is Robin. I'm going to shout Robin out for giving me that, because that has been a practice that I've introduced and it's been amazing.
Mm. Well, you are amazing.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad. And you're doing God's work. You know, you're doing you're doing incredible work. And I so appreciate you sharing your story and then also how your story is connected to the work that you do. And forget and to get people to realize what's really happening out there mm-hmm. that we don't see, mm-hmm. you know, that happens behind closed mahogany doors or papers on an attorney's yes. desk. Do you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
To know where you come from, to own your identity, is to first understand who are the people that brought you into this world. Who should keep a parent's story if a child is surrendered or forced into care by the state? Who is the person that holds the truth as to why? When parents are losing their children based on a bad decision, not abuse or neglect, where is the line? In a previous podcast with Shanti Ryan, she so eloquently said, "We are all almost innocent of some infraction." And as we hear from Keisha, from both sides of the table, there are systems in place that are terrifyingly swift in separating parents from their children. Thank you, Keisha, for your sharing your story, for advocating for those who need our help, and for bringing to light the current injustices that deserve our attention. Until next time, stay curious and be well.